Good evening, everyone. I want to welcome you to the Expanded Budget Committee for the fourth night. And before we begin, I want to propose something to you to let you think about for a while. There's a conversation that we're having about setting a public hearing day on October 30th, which is the day before Halloween, and then voting on the budget on November 9th. And I want people to think about that a little bit and not make a decision today, but that's a proposal we're putting out, as opposed to one that would have us voting way into November 21st, I think it is. So keep that in mind, and we'll get back to you. Will?
So we are, as of September 22nd, we will be down one member. And are you talking about a budget for the whole legislature?
Yeah, on November 9th. And we will have that new member in the building on November 9th. She is going away after that, and she will not be here for a meeting if we were holding it on November 21st. Am I right, Shauna? Okay. So that
makes a very good date.
Yeah, you're right.
And Kathy has something.
I'd just like to also mention that I need to have a certified through the Board of Elections before the person can take office. Yeah. And I'm not sure if that could happen by November 9th.
So if that were not to happen and not certified, then the actual threshold for a majority vote is less. It's only 7 votes. Is that correct?
No.
No? And so
still 8 votes, majority.
We're a 14-member group.
But if we're 13 members, then the majority would be 7.
No, it would still be 8. You're still a 14-member legislature.
Even
with
even
a vacancy.
Even for an unfilled seat.
That's correct.
We're a 14-member board.
Yes, Will.
Everybody seems to agree on this. So I think we got to get certified if we can do that.
We certainly hope so. Welcome, assigned counsel. You are on.
Good evening.
Good evening. As you'll see from our budget presentation, what you see here is a reflection of the changes in the program over time. These changes are mainly a reflection of the changes in mandated representation that are occurring across the state, particularly in upstate New York. We're now at the 2018 budget at you see in terms of full-time equivalents, 4.11. That's a reflection of, you'll see there, we have myself, an administrative aide, 3 who are considered part-time, and then the 3 other staff add up to the 3.11, essentially, full-time equivalents there on that. The main issues that we're currently working on that affect us are the centralized arraignments process. That's ongoing. Two parts, I guess, consistent of the after-hours arraignments, which are an important process, have an important impact, or contribute to some of the processes we see with the jail and other issues that get reflected in the overall county budget. I think tied to that, the staff tries to be responsive in terms of the jail study, the centralized arraignment studies, these task forces in terms of data provision. The second major thing we're engaged in is our ongoing quality enhancement of the program. That focuses on both our office capacities to respond to the needs of the county for data collection. We're bringing a new online data system on board this fall that'll improve our ability to respond to questions from the legislature for data that we anticipate will be ongoing in terms of things like the jail study, some of these processes. The other components we focus on that are ongoing are training programs for the attorneys, the provision of CLEs, other training programs. We seek to support that, the cost of those, at least in part through grants we receive from the state government through the Office of Indigent Legal Services. We try to cover as much of that as we can through grant processes with the state that are ongoing and in increasing as a result of some of the recent and ongoing changes in how the state is looking at funding mandated representation. And then we're also advising, collaborating with various counties on their assigned counsel programs and to set up and enhance both overall. We're also getting inquiries in terms of, because we have a grants and training coordinator, which is a little unique in terms of our capacity to support them. So that remains a possibility. You could see us coming and asking for something similar to the Schuyler County Intermunicipal Agreement, where someone will pay us, or pay the county, rather, to provide those types of supports on that. So you see in our budget here, we have a change from 2017 to the 2018 budget we're requesting. The change there you see the net local at $211,000. The increase is reflective of a couple major things occurring. Those are the change in more money to cover the change in guidelines, increasing that increases the pool of eligible applicants to receive representation through our program. That's mandated by the state. They've changed the guidelines, which is expanding that pool. And the second item you see there is the OTR. We're requesting the $100,000. That's all to cover mandated representation. We had very unusual this year in that we have eight high-profile cases, or eight defendants in high-profile cases that are extremely costly. Those are mainly that murder cases, attempted murder cases. Those are high-cost cases, tend to involve complex legal issues which require expert witnesses, a voluminous amount of materials provided as a result of any investigation. So that OTR is specifically to cover those costs as best we could calculate them looking forward. And those are all costs we're mandated to provide as part of the representation. You'll notice there, you'll see a slight decrease. When you looked at the budget, we had a slight decrease in revenues. The revenues are the state grant money coming in. That's reflective of a couple of things. Some old grants ending, and we have new grants in the process of being approved by OILS. So we expect there'll be additional money coming in, so you may see that blip. We also have a delay in payments. The state, as you may be aware, can be a little slow at times in terms of compensating us for costs generated, and that's what's kind of created that. That's, we don't really see that as a an ongoing issue. We anticipate from our discussions with the state and what they're telling us in the grants we have in place, you're going to see additional and ongoing funds flowing from OILS as part of the grant process on that.
Let's talk about maintenance.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say also, it's very strange for us to do an over-target request on a mandated account, but we feel that this is an anomaly, that this is a one-time thing. We don't think that there's going to be 8 high-profile crimes, hopefully, every single year. So we're not asking for the mandate to be increased by that much. We just think by doing it this way, we're showing you that we think it's just an anomaly that just unfortunately happened at this time.
And if you look at those crimes, they're not reflective of a pattern of behavior and increase. They all, five of them are connected with one case, 5 of the defendants, which creates a huge cost out of one case. But the other ones are all, several of those are rather unique in cases that the county's never seen here before. We probably won't see again just because of the nature of a couple of those offenses. So we don't anticipate that. The other major influences we see are, of course, that I mentioned, the change in the state financial guidelines that's resulting in more clients being assigned that were mandated to cover in criminal cases. That also has an impact on our family court costs. Even though it's not mandated, the judges tend to approve. They're aware of the changes in guidelines. So we see a little increase there as well. We also have increased involvement from the Office of Indigent Legal Services concerning financial payments to the county. They're requiring additional data reporting and collection. That's reflective. That's come with the governor's new proposals in terms of state funding to support us, which are good, but the Office of the State Comptroller now oils are now requesting, of course, with that they want additional reporting to document, of course, how we're spending the money. So that takes additional staff time. That's work for us. And of course, as I mentioned, we're seeing multiple requests from other counties regarding assistance with their programs. That's always occurred at some level in terms of Julia's always been viewed as a major resource for the state for that they refer other counties to. With the increase in state funding, they're doing that at an increased level. They're asking for her input as well. With oils, they're trying to design model program guidelines for counties as they're going to be funding those. So we're seeing which results in increased requests from counties for assistance from us.
Questions for Lance. Julie.
This is more for our viewing audience. I don't believe that either of you gave your names before you spoke, so it would be nice if you would just identify yourselves.
My
I know
apologies.
Who you are, but...
I'm Lance Salisbury. I'm the supervising attorney for assigned counsel. Julia Hughes is the program coordinator for assigned counsel.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions for Lance or Julia? Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
This is kind of off topic, but I mean, you have big cases. Like,
Mike, you want to use your microphone, please?
Yes. There are like 5 murderers, I guess, right now or something like that. How do you find the attorneys that are qualified to do that?
What we do is we have on our panel, we've identified by skill levels what attorneys can handle what level of cases. We have a small number of attorneys based on experience and review who are qualified to handle cases of that level. We typically get the judges will give us some input as well. The other thing we've been doing is, because we've lost in terms of those qualified attorneys to handle murder cases, one became a city court judge, one became the district attorney. they're not available. So
stealing from you.
Yeah, they are. So what we've done with some grant money is we've been second chairing attorneys who are kind of on that threshold, so we're building our capacity to increase that. But it's basically Julia and myself, and we'll consult with the county court judges oftentimes. We have an idea of which attorneys can handle what types of cases.
Is my assumption correct then that those attorneys probably get paid more for those cases?
No. They get paid the same. The rates are mandated by the state. And what the practical effect is, those cases take a lot more time. So they're billing more, but they're paid at the same rates as everyone else.
Leslie.
Thank you. So the things that are mandated by the state, I think it's always important for our viewing audience, if anybody is there, to hear a little bit more about. I'm interested in hearing what does the $100,000 pay for? And what I mean is, were we paying $60 an hour, now the state is saying we have to pay $75?
Right.
What is it doing?
These major cases, attorneys are paid $75 an hour. They're all felonies. They're typically A1 or an A2 felony. So they're paid $75 an hour. So what this $100,000 costs is to cover the attorney's costs primarily. Typically, there are also expert witnesses required in these cases. A murder case typically has more involved legal issues. That creates more attorney costs in terms of research, but oftentimes you need an expert. If there's a fire involved, you may need a fire expert. You may need pathologists, those types of things.
Okay. So the state hasn't increased what we're supposed to pay the attorneys per hour?
No.
That hasn't happened. May I ask another question?
Sure.
About how many attorneys do you have on your roster who you can call on any time for cases? About how many attorneys do we manage to assign counsel?
We have approximately maybe between 45 and 50. We have lost a lot of them, unfortunately, to big jobs. Some of them, one became the public defender in Tioga County after I helped them set up their program.
You need to stop it.
and other, like I said, when Lance said, one became the DA, one became city court. So we have lost some. So we're down to about 45 to 50, and they all do various things. Some do both family court. Some do both family court and criminal court. Some only do family. Some only do criminal.
Ask one more question. I lied. I had one more. And with the sort of the new thing that we've been doing in the last year or two, with attorneys being present at the time that somebody first appears before a judge, even if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, are you seeing an increase in the amount of money you're spending because of that?
Yes, I mean, somewhat. That cost, we have we've been able to capture much of that cost through grants from the state. We've been lucky there. We were one of the early implementers, and they've been supportive of that.
That's one of the areas also where the state statute, when it came out, said that they are going to cover. It's called counsel at first appearance.
Right.
They're also going to cover quality improvement and caseload relief. Those are the three areas that the state says that they're going to pay for us 100% over a 7-year period, and that's one of the areas where they're
actually doing it.
They're adamant that they want that to go forward and to be in existence. So I don't, we're getting a lot of help from the state on that.
Are they paying 100%?
Right now they're paying for most of the after hours arraignments. That's what we have in our grants, yes.
Thank you. And for those of you who couldn't follow my gibberish, I love how you corrected it nicely. Counsel at first appearance, as opposed to the thing we started to do. I got it. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Up next is assessment. Jay Franklin and Irene Keel are here.
Thank you.
Ready?
You're on.
First of all, I'd like to thank Kevin for this great setup. I'm sure Autumn had a little bit to do with it as well. The seat was a little bit too high up, though. Sorry, little inside joke there. Humorous to me on a Thursday morning. So. Yeah. You all know me. I'm Jay Franklin, the director of assessment. To my left is Irene Keough. She's my assistant director. You all know us by now. We've been here. I think this is my 8th budget presentation now as director. I've been with the county for 22 years. Irene has been
18,
give or take. I don't know what I'd do without her. Luckily, she has agreed to stay on for 18 more years as long as me, too. So
you have to keep doing it till you do it right.
So here's a kind of a snapshot of our last year's budget and this year. This year, we're requesting a little over $100,000 less. That's really due to one-time funding that we had in our budget for our digital sketch program that was preliminary approved for us to spend at this last GO meeting and will be before you on Tuesday. Also for a real property tax law 520 database, but rather than spend that money, I actually just designed it in-house. I figured I could do the better alternative than somebody else designing it. Pretty much everything else is the same. Small line items, adjustments. We have about $4,000 increase in our budget for a tax bill paper purchase. When we buy tax bill paper, we like to buy it in bulk. It's a much better cost, and we can just store it out back. Also, a little bit increase in postage. With the number of assessment changes we're making this year, we felt having that increase in postage would be advantageous to us. Shock what our major influence is here, but the real estate activity. Our market is very strong still, our residential resale market, that's just houses that have already been built that are selling again, is just as strong as ever. Every week when I look at the sales, I kind of shake my head, and I thought we kind of hit that peak of the market, but then the next sale comes through and it kind of blows it away. For our 2018 annual equity maintenance AEM program, we're going to look at around 8,200 residential parcels. We'll be in the city of Ithaca, Ellis Hollow, the Cigarette Streets, and Cuga Heights, predominantly. We're looking at all of the vacant lands within the county as well, all 4,966 parcels. And also looking at around the 24,000 residential land values. That's kind of one of those projects that has been on the back burner as we looked at the overall land, overall total value of a property. We've kind of just said we don't really need to know about the land value of that because the overall is what people buy. You don't say, I'm going to buy your house for $25,000 for that land and I'll pay you $175,000 for your building, so I'll pay you $200,000. So we've kind of focused on what we have the capacity to focus on, that overall value. Now, one of the things I was always told kind of growing up in this business is you can see how well a community is doing when you can count the cranes in the community. And there's a very, very large crane that I can see right across my computer monitors on my desk. That had to be one of the biggest cranes I've seen. And when the Hilton Garden was built, one of my employees spent a very good time watching that. And I think he would have been amazed at seeing the size of that crane. But as you all are aware, apartments, building of apartments is a hot ticket item right now. We keep track of it. I have about 43 projects that I consider active. They're either under construction, I think they're on track to be built, but they may still be in that planning phase. All told, it's about 2,421 units with about 4,298 bedrooms. And that doesn't even count what Cornell is planning on doing on their campus to house all of their freshmen and sophomores. You know, I've heard that's about 2,000 new beds. Whatever Cornell does with East Hill in their Maplewood Phase 2 and their East Hill Village. And then our, what I term as our new municipality, the chain work districts out there. Plus, if you add in all of the other commercial projects that are going on, you have McGuire's, Guthrie bought a couple new buildings down near Carpenter, which I thought they were going to expand more, but Cuga Medical kind of put a quash to that. Cargill, Cuga Solar, the Hilton Canopy, the Trust Company, Herald Square, the airport land moving the DOT, the prior DOT site, the town of Lansing's land. Now, you may look at these and say, it's just one project. But when they come to me, it's one project this week. But last week, it was a slightly different project that they want an estimate on. So it may come to me in 7-8 different iterations that we have to take a look at, review, analyze, talk to the developer about it. And these are just the ones that are kind of out there in the open. You know, there isn't a day that we don't get a phone call from a developer saying, hey, I got this idea. How do you assess property? What's going on? How are you going to look at this income-producing property? And one other thing on here is when I started 22 years ago, things were a lot easier. You know, it wasn't always easy, but now they're much more complex. We have to look at these apartments that are being built that are actually losing money. When you look at an income property, typically your investor is going to look at it based upon its income stream. If it has no income, it has no value. So these projects that we're starting to see are actually have a business plan to lose money in the first few years after construction. Banking on rents would appreciate, maybe they can knock down some expenses, and also that at the end of their holding period, they'll actually make money when they go to sell. And that's a tough sell for us as assessors to tell someone, we're going to base your value, your current value today, based upon a calculation on what we think it's going to be worth in 20 years. If I knew what property would be worth in 20 years, I wouldn't be sitting in front of you today. So it's just much, much more complex. Sales involve the 1031 exchanges. There's a lot more where the seller is actually holding the paper, holding the mortgage, and allowing a buyer to buy more property for a little less money. Some of the loans we're seeing on commercial properties are reminiscent of loans I've heard that happened in the 80s, and bad things happened in the 80s. Hopefully it didn't happen. Now, hopefully it won't happen from what we're seeing, but in talking with older and wiser appraisers, the deals that they're seeing today are reminiscent of what they saw in the 80s, where the income just isn't supporting its projects. So here's a little history of our full-time equivalents over the years. It doesn't really do justice to stop at 2015 when we had 12 and a half. So going back to 2000, we actually had 19 full-time equivalents in our office. We were able to reduce that down to 10. But based upon where we're at in the real estate market, I know over the years I've had kind of requests from a few legislators saying, do you have enough staff? And I said, yes, we have enough staff to do our job. The real estate market's manageable. Well, now I'm coming to you to say the real estate market's not manageable anymore. We need to start building up our staff again. So included in our budget will be an OTR for another full-time real property appraiser. I put in the IAAO standard. It's the International Association of Assessing Officers. And for every 2,500 parcels, they recommend one full-time equivalent. So with our 36,000-plus parcels, that would put us at about 14.7. But for 2018, we're only requesting 12.2. I have a very good staff, a very experienced staff would be a good way to put it, and they're able to do more things under less time. In 7-8 years, when they start to retire, we may be looking back more to that 14.7, 15 people, but for now, they're good. So here is that OTR for that real property appraiser. This would be a target OTR because we need them more than just next year. So the reasons for this would be the increase in the real estate market, the demand for real property tax information. Every day I get a request to run a report. Can you look at this? I need all of the buildings within College Town. Or, you know, what's the tax base for College Town versus the tax base for downtown? And how does that compare from when I ran it in 2006 and 10 and 16? We talked about the increase of complexity of real estate transactions. Nothing is ever as simple as it seems. When I first started, you could just call up and ask how many bedrooms, how many bathrooms. But now we really have to dive into why did you buy the property? Not just simply what is the property, but what motivated that person? Why did they buy that house? Why did they buy that income-producing property when it looks like they're going to lose money in the first 5 years? About a month or so ago, we got awarded a pilot county for our real property system, V5. I think 2 years ago I came to you with an OTR hoping for a new system. Luckily, the state has wisdom, finally, and decided to choose Tyler Technologies for their real property system, V5. Finally, I may be able to get my third computer off my desk, an old XP box that can only run taxes on that. So hopefully we'll be a pilot for that. Problem with being a pilot is you got to do duplicate entry. So besides maintaining all of our data in V5, we'll also have to maintain it in V4. So it's a little extra work, but I think being a part of that pilot is well worth it, so we'll be able to guide it, tweak it, and hopefully make it better than the current system we got. And then future retirement considerations, as I look around my office, 7-8 years, it'll be a dramatically different office than it is today. And I think it's never too early to start planning for that.
Questions for Jay and Irene. Mike Lane.
Jay, you just sent a shudder down my back talking about the losing money properties, and I wish I assume some of them they're keeping up with tax credits in some way. Some of the housing. We've got a housing study that says we need to push a lot more housing in Tompkins County. Are we going to be to a point where we're going to have a bust? And prices are going to collapse, and we're going to have a lot on the market. Landlords not being able to maintain the properties the way they ought to. Are we going to? I well remember the 80s that you mentioned. Center Ithaca was a perfect example of kind of a push to get that financed, and it just didn't make it. I think there was a bankruptcy involved with that one. But I just wonder if you're the canary in the coal mine here telling us that we ought to be really careful and not to push this into a large boom if in a few years we're not going to be able to support the quality of housing that we're building. I don't know whether you want to respond to that or not, but that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I mean, with everything that we have planned right now, it seems to be a significant amount of projects. There isn't, you know, a week that doesn't go by that I don't get pulled aside by one of the area landlords and say, hey, I have this apartment that's vacant. It's never been vacant before. So I don't know if that's kind of returning to a more normal vacancy, and they've been spoiled over the years. But the thing that really concerns me is when you have an income-producing property, over the years, you wanted to put money in your pocket at the end of the day. At the end of the year, you weren't putting money into it each year. It's a very speculative market right now, and that's not something that we had had over the years. We didn't go boom and bust in the middle 2000s. We still steadily kind of increased. So it's something to be aware of and something that we have to watch out on.
Questions or comments? Will and then Dooley.
Jay, on that, is that something that you sense is just happening here, or are you hearing from your colleagues in other communities that this is a wider spread phenomenon?
I mean, we're definitely the prize in Central New York. When the land value in College Town sells for somewhere between $200 and $450 a square foot, in order to support that type of land value, even with their zero setbacks and, you know, going up 7-8 stories, you know, it takes a lot to be able to support that sort of land value. You know, the $16 million construction cost and you pay 7 for the land, that kind of normal relationship is kind of out of whack on what the land value is and what sort of improvements you're putting on it. Not saying, you know, there's much smarter people than me doing the financials, but there's other things that are coming into consideration rather than just the money at the end of the day.
Okay. And on your computer, I guess it was a previous slide, you were talking the pilot for Volume 5. Am I right that essentially you have to use software that the state mandates that all sewer offices use? Is that what that is?
We're not mandated, but they provide it to us.
Okay.
One benefit of being countywide assessing is we're looked at as one assessing unit. So they charge us $2,000 a year. If we were in Oswego County, the charge as a county may be $60,000.
Wow.
So financially, it's better for us to do it. And if you said, Jay, here's a blank check, go buy the best assessment system that you want, we would have Tyler. So the state has picked the right choice, and it's really the only choice.
I hear that. Thank you.
Dooley.
Thank you. I was looking at the membership dues that you pay in one of the appendices, and there's something called Caspios. I just don't know what it is.
Yeah. Caspio is an online database, so we actually use it to allow for online grievance applications. So when someone is contesting their assessment, and after I bought it, it's also used for our grants management database that I worked with Paula to help design and be able to have a central location for all grants within the county. So we're able to piggyback that grants management database onto our subscription for the grievance applications.
Thank you. And do your staff actually take vacations?
Yes, they do.
That's a serious question.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
No, they're very, very good about taking time, and you know, I think Irene can speak to us, but I think we have a fun office. You know, for what we do, and that's one thing that I try to do is to have fun in the office. So if you come over at 8 o'clock on Friday mornings, you can come play putt-putt with us. We're more than willing. We had a couple guest balls for you. So there's some things to do to have some fun within the office. When you're there, you know, 8.5 hours a day, 5 days a week, have some fun.
But also real vacations from the office.
Yeah, we give them their 10-minute breaks.
No. Anyone else for Jay or Ivan? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay. Youth Services, Amy Hendricks.
By the time Amy comes and gets set up, you know, one of the things that I appreciate about Jay's office, too, is just the fact that aside from all that they do, they're always involved in other things, whether it's diversity and inclusion efforts, cake, bake-off, whatever it is. And so I really do appreciate that about you all. I'm talking about y'all.
Thank you.
Big things. It's a little toned down this year. All right. So I'm Amy Hendricks, and this is Teresa Albert from the Youth Services Department. And here's our 2018 budget presentation. I always start all of our presentations with our mission. I think that's really important for people to understand what we do as a department and how we're investing time, resources, and funding in communities to work with young people. We actually don't work with any youth directly, and people are often surprised about that. We work with the communities to help support young people. So here is our recommended budget. You can see there's some changes. Those changes are due primarily to the loss of our federal Stop Act grant and drug-free communities grant. So we knew that these were going away and sunsetting, and this has been happening for some time. This 2017 marks the last year of those grant sources. Another small piece of this is also we had brought in some Park Foundation funding for a research project that we've been working on this current year. Our FTEs, another little story here. We actually do have six FTEs this year, but how we did that was bringing in funding through other departments, so you're not seeing that. So it looks like we're increasing quite a bit, but we're actually maintaining status quo as we head into 2018. When I look at the Youth Services Department, this year we spent a lot of time working on results-based accountability as a department. We spent a lot of time working with our contract partners, and now it's our chance to really look at our own performance measures and how we're doing things. And one of the keys to that is looking at who we're serving and who are our customers. So this slide actually shows how we now divided the workload of the Youth Services Department into three areas. So we have the administration and operations that really looks at how we're using our resources and how others are using our resources. The community coordination piece, which is in the center, is really how we're working with all of our partners. So anyone that touches the lives of youth 0 to 24, we consider a partner. That's who we're focusing on. So how we're working with our partners in the various community agencies that we're working with. And then data collection and quality management is really another piece of ensuring that the quality of all the programs that we're funding and our partners can call upon us to ensure we're really meeting those needs for young people. So major influences as we started to prepare this budget, working with the Youth Services Advisory Board, they had asked, you know, what could we do? And I actually brought our staff together to say, what do we need? What would make us perform better? And the first thing that came up was electronics. We haven't replaced our computers in quite a while, so it's time to look at that, replacing all of the staff's computers and our laptops. Another thing that came to really a discussion point was our youth development survey. So as I mentioned, we had the drug-free communities grant, and we've also had the Stop Act grant, and those grants provided some foundation for the youth development survey. This is a survey done every other year. It was last done in 2016, so you may have seen the data recently from 2017. It takes us about 3 to 6 months to pull all that information and give it back to the community. In 2018, we'll be asking to do that survey again. And it's a partnership where the school districts provide some of the support, as well as the students. They take it in the schools. They provide some of the funding and then the resources. The Community Coalition for Healthy Youth also supports that, and then local nonprofits. So it's a partnership project. But we had a lot of funding from those grant sources that we no longer have. And so those were our first two over-target requests that we put in with the request to use rollover for those two things. As we move through, we also started looking at our agency services. In 2017, we began a new funding cycle for our agencies. So we contract with various agencies to provide services in the community. And when we did that, we had started a project called Achieving Youth Results, where we really started looking at what the community needs to improve from where we're at. We have some really great things going on in Tompkins County. Our graduation rates are comparable. We don't have things that are spiking huge concerns. However, not all of our young people are successful and thriving at this point. So Achieving Youth Results really went to the communities and said, what little pieces do you need to take us to that next step? And so as we started to bring all of that together, we weren't really ready to bring that into the 2017 funding cycle. And so we provided our funding to agencies that we believe in and support. And a part of this was, now how do we continue to enhance those services? We also looked at our contracted agencies, and we include in our contracted agencies the municipalities that we also contract with. And they've seen minimal increases. Last year I was here talking about a 2% increase for cost of living on those agencies. They don't receive the same cost of living increase that our other agencies that contract directly with the county receive. And so that was something that was concerning to us, is that they needed to continue to have that cost of living because, again, their expenses have continued to go up. The other piece was training and technical assistance. We've designated a lot of our time looking at the quality of our programs and meeting with our contract agencies as well as other agencies that we don't contract with, asking about what their needs are for training and technical assistance. As our nonprofits have faced really difficult fiscal times, they've often cut back their training services, and so we've started to provide those services to those agencies, and we've been doing this for the last 3 years. So that's where you'll see our over-target requests. And you'll see that we're asking once again for that cost of living adjustment for our agencies, the youth worker training program, and then what we're calling the Achieving Youth Results mini-grant program. So I'm going to provide you a few more details on those things and then go ahead and ask for questions. So the cost of living adjustment for our contracts, as I mentioned, we don't receive that for our contracts as other contracts do. So that's where this is coming from, is asking for target dollars to go ahead and increase the cost of living for all of our contracts on that 2% level. The youth worker training program. In 2012, we began looking at how our programs were being provided. As we started to see that more youth workers needed training, we started to come up with a program that really would provide annual services to youth workers. And we wanted to make sure that the training program had sustainability. Many of our youth workers, I was asked, do they stay in the community? They often do stay in the community. Some of them stay with the same program. Often they're switching between programs. This is their passion, and so we're building on those training series. So we may have some basic trainings, and I'll put some up for you. But then we also continue to explore new concepts with the trainings, really look at what else is needed in the community. And as we're doing some of our evaluations, we can say, oh, you know, one of those was talking about conflict transformation and how do you do that in a program when you have 20 young people? How do you stop and help with that conflict piece? And so as we start hearing that feedback, we've pulled a lot of different trainings together. We've hosted about 400 participants annually in these training programs, and we actually had one today where people learned about how to develop youth programs using the art of play. So they vary quite a bit. And then the final request is for our Achieving Youth Results. So as I mentioned, this was something that we brought into the community, and we asked the community to help us set 6 goals for Tompkins County young people. And so these are the 6 goals. They're very broad, very overarching. With each of these goals, we also have indicators that we're looking at to see how we're meeting these goals. We know that no one agency, program, service, or funding stream can actually help us change these goals, that it's going to take really a community to do this. And so we brought these goals and our indicators back to the community, and we held we had 70 round tables with hundreds of community residents where they weighed in on it. They looked at that information and said, you know what would really help us make better high school graduation rates? We really need to help with, and I'm just using an example, we need help with making sure that every kid comes to school well-fed. And we know we have some programs, and this is what this could help us close the gap. So we have all of this great information, and we've been looking at it and thinking, okay, now what do we do with it? So we're providing funding to various agencies and organizations already, and this concept came from my board as well as some of my staff members saying, what if we were to look at this and use a small amount of county commitment for each of the goal areas and ask the community, you've proposed these ideas, could you come back to us and show us a way to make this happen? And we could provide some of that startup funding for that. So this is a very new and kind of innovative concept for us to look at this small mini grant. This has the potential to be a matching program, and so what it would allow is if we were to invest, you know, $30,000 of county funding, perhaps we'd have a one-in-one match, could expand to $60,000. I mean, those details are not finalized at this point, but this was the concept, is providing some kind of incentive to move all of those small ideas forward and not having not having the traditional barriers that some of our other larger programs have. And finally, before I go to questions, it is our 40th anniversary this year. We do have a very strong social media presence where we've been asking for people to tell the stories of caring adults in their lives. We've collected, I want to say, about 110 accepted stories. So we asked people to nominate, and then we asked the nominees if they would like to accept the nomination. So 110 people have accepted that nomination, and we're going to be randomly selecting the 40 of those stories to share at our anniversary celebration on October 18th, which all the members of the legislature will be getting invitations soon. But I wanted to make sure that you knew October 18th at 5:30 p.m. We'll be having that anniversary celebration.
Questions for the director? Will.
Amy, on the drug and alcohol survey, you've been doing it, you lost the funding for it. Can you point to some concrete successes or things that have come out of that makes it worth continuing?
Sure. So I would say some of the success, when we do that survey, we always share all the information with all the school districts first because they're our partner with that. So when we bring them together, the school district decides what their teams look like. Every school district's team looks a little different. They really dive into that information and then can provide that back to the schools. And what we've seen is in some schools, they will choose a topic. So one school district may have chosen bullying one year, and really focus on that. So then the next year that we do the survey, so in a couple years, they can start to see, are their efforts really helping pay off? So it's been a really a good piece to help look at what services and supports do we need. Often it's seen as the alcohol and drug survey. It does have a lot of those questions, but it also has questions about community, adult relationships, parenting, and so we've started to expand it and look a little bit deeper. This year, probably mid-fall, we'll be releasing some supplemental information. This was the first year that we asked about gender identity and sexuality, so we're going to be looking at that and seeing how experiences change based on that information. We're also going to be looking, so the survey, the instrument itself, we purchase and then add additional questions. We have very limited control over those additional questions, but we'll be looking a little bit deeper at some of those other pieces that we haven't always had the chance. While the survey was, or the funding was great to have, it also drove us to really look at that alcohol and drug piece. And so this is freeing us up a little to look at those other components.
And are there others in communities doing the same survey or similar?
Yeah.
And do we have a basis of comparison? What problems are evident here that might not be?
Yes. So there are communities. We can compare it. It's a national tool. It's very validated. Some of the things that we see is one of the trends that we always see are students' acceptance of marijuana as they believe marijuana is a much safer drug in Tompkins County than in other counties. That's one that always sticks out. But there's other things that we've started to track. Community commitment. We know that sad and depressed most days is one of the questions. We're on par with our national peers. That's not great. We would probably like to lower that because that's about one-third of our students are saying that they're sad or depressed. on most days, but we do compare nationally and compare locally with some others that use the same instrument.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Rich.
I wanted to ask about the $30,000 grant program. It seemed like there's some good overarching goals, but I didn't have a clear understanding. What do you think that money would be used for? You mentioned school lunch programs, but we have those, right?
Right.
So what would...
Right. So what was interesting about our whole process is we went into the communities, and we found that there are significant gaps of people that may not know about those programs. So it may not be purchasing the food. It may be an awareness campaign that maybe the, you know, just using that example, they don't have that extra small piece to get them there. The other things are some of the simple ideas that came out. So one of the pieces was really about intergenerational programs. There are a lot of groups that do some of that, but they may be very localized in a certain area. So one of the pieces is we could bring those groups together and start having conversations about what does it take to have an intergenerational program. And it may not be a huge financial push. It may be something small. What I think we're looking at with this grant program is something to kind of move it forward, to give the people. Often the first thing you hear is we don't have the money to do that. And this gives that little incentive to say, well, you do have a few thousand dollars or whatever to do it. So then where do we go from there? And then the matching piece is so we can start to build in that sustainability. So it's not an ongoing piece every time.
Anyone else? Mike.
Maybe something more in general. My town has a lot of mobile home parks. Mm-hmm. Other towns have a lot of mobile home parks. There are children in these mobile home parks that are often disadvantaged. What programs are we funding to get to them, and particularly what are we taking to them as opposed to expecting them to be transported to mm-hmm. other areas?
So in your case, we have the Rural Youth Services ARS program. And so what that program does is started actually with a student from Dryden who was at Cornell and wanted people to have that experience. And she came from the mobile home park. And so she had came up with this program, and we've invested into this program where young people from Cornell go to the mobile homes, and they actually transport with the Rural Youth Services program manager to 4-H Acres, and it's an ongoing program. Now, that's something, because we do the municipal youth services, and the way we develop that system is we give the funding to the municipality, and then they determine how they want to respond to that. So in that municipality, that's where that program was built. That hasn't happened in some of the other municipalities. Now, it's not to say that they are not interested, but they've built other programs that they want to continue. So, you know, in other communities, they may be more invested into the youth employment piece, and they're still doing the outreach, but it's not designated for that particular area. So I think it's something that can continue to be looked at, but it's run through our municipal youth services at this time, and each municipality gets that local control of their funding.
And I know that's a really exemplary program that they've started, but that's not all the mobile home parks,
no.
Even in the town.
No.
It's just one particular area. I've always thought that we need to get to the very young children and let them know that there are ways out by education and other kinds of things like that. And I don't think we're doing enough of that.
No. And honestly, through Achieving Youth Results and some of that, that came out. So I wouldn't be, if we were to look at that, I wouldn't be surprised if there were other organizations looking at that and just needing, again, that little extra push to get there.
Thank you. Mike. Thank
you. The thing that Travis runs...
Mm-hmm.
In the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any... So that's paid for through your organization, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to extend the hours?
Oh.
Just because I know a lot of people can't use it, but they really like it because it's inexpensive.
Right.
The problem is the hours don't fit their work schedule. So
right.
It's like, you know, not me, but...
So what Mike's referring to is a summer youth program through the Municipal Youth Service System. We contract with Rural Youth Services to do that. And sometimes the hours are difficult. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. Some of that is it's a very specific program. It is not a camp, which means you have to be very cautious of those hours because there's all sorts of camp regulations. The other side of that is because those employees are year-round. Under the new Fair Labor Standards Act, they've been watching kind of the hours. But I think that it's also that municipal piece where it's the local control. And so if the Lansing Youth Commission were to look at it and say, you know, it might make more sense to do it 3 days a week and extend the hours, that's something they could determine. But it's that local piece.
Okay. Amy, do you want to do the youth services rec?
Sure.
Partnership?
It'll be very brief.
All right.
So here we go. Oh, didn't know I had that planned. So here are the expenditures. Ooh, I broke the computer.
That was fast.
I told you. All right. So the expenditures for Rec Partnership are here. They are under that contract agency 2% increase, and so you'll see that revenues have increased by that, and then here's the net local. And that's all.
Simply, where does this money go?
Simply. So this money goes directly to the Ithaca Youth Bureau for the Recreation Partnership Program. It's with all of the municipalities in the county except the town of Lansing to provide services to all youth through recreation partnership activities.
Julie?
I'm on Appendix B, page 13, and I'm looking at the City of Ithaca Youth Bureau, mm-hmm. and in particular the outing program, which... Mm-hmm. didn't appear to exist in 2015 or 16, did exist in 2017, and is decreased by half for 2018, and I just wanted to know the story of that.
No. Okay, so outings program... We did not fund them this year.
It's outings with an S, because outing could mean many things.
Yes.
And I wasn't sure about that.
Yes.
It doesn't have the S on it.
It doesn't.
Yes. Okay. So their program, we began funding last year when we had the open budget cycle. They had requested funding to expand the program on a one-time basis, and then when we put our request for proposals out this year, our renewal applications, they only had asked for the proposal that you see there. So they didn't ask for the increase again.
Was there a problem with the program?
No. The program is operating pretty wonderfully, and we're working with them, but they just haven't expanded it and didn't request that.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Thank you.
I have mental health and public health. And Frank is...
I have to be like this.
Okay. All right. Whatever.
There you go. Two microphones, wow. Before I get started, first thing I have to do is say hi to my daughter Lily, who's watching us at home on television. So hi, Lily. She watches religiously with me. We're some of your viewers that you're always referring to. And I joke with Joe, she's either going to grow up to be part of government or overthrow it. We'll just have to wait and see how that goes. So we're starting first with public health tonight. I'm Frank Krupa. I am the public health director. With me is Brenda Grinnell Crosby. She's our public health administrator and the one responsible for crunching all the numbers together for us. So let's get started. So first thing up, mission, vision, and values, just as Amy stated, is something that's core and very important to us at the department. It hangs all throughout our building, and it's just important to make sure that we start there, knowing what it is we're doing, what we're trying to achieve, and how we're going to do it. So we always like to share that with folks. So I want to talk a little bit about what we do at the health department, how our different divisions are kind of identified and what the folks there do. And then we're going to talk a little bit about how the money breaks up in those different areas to hopefully give you guys a little bit of a deeper dive into the health department and its budget. So we have four main divisions. First one here tonight is our administration division. Brenda leads that division, and it is what you would imagine. The bulk of it is our keeping the doors on, keeping the doors open, keeping the lights on, paying the bills, doing all that good stuff. But we also have some programming that lives within the division, starting with our county health and safety program. So you may be aware that we house and lead the program that oversees health and safety for our 700-plus county employees to make sure that their workplaces are safe and healthy, and trying to support the department heads in those efforts. Also within that division is public health preparedness. You see what's going on in Texas and Florida, and I can tell you all of my former colleagues in Florida have been busy working long shifts, many hours, responding, because those events are public health significant. And so we do everything we can to make sure we're as prepared as we can be here in Tompkins County for those types of events, both natural and man-made. Health promotion, this is a shift. We recently, within the last couple of years, we moved this program into administration because we're trying to keep up with the evolution of public health. Traditionally, public health has been service-driven. We've provided things like primary care and well child visits, a lot of things that we've started to move away from. And as that transition occurs, what we're beginning to focus more on is education and outreach and collaboration building. So we want to bring our expertise around public health interventions and get community partners together to help us achieve our goals. We have our vital records, which is birth and death certificates. So if you are born or die here in Tompkins County, we have the record of that and can provide it for you for a small fee. And then financial management. Our second division is community health. Within that, that's our traditional nursing division. So we do have our women, infants, and children, which is a part of that. So for those that aren't familiar, it's a nutrition-based supplemental program which provides education as well as resources for families to help children have the best starts that they can. Our communicable disease program lives there, which is what a lot of folks traditionally align with the health department, so things like sexually transmitted infections or other communicable diseases like TB, those that can be passed from person to person. And we also have a Medicaid obstetrics maternal services program, which is a home-based nursing service. Our nurses will go into the home with a pregnant mom that is a Medicaid recipient and will provide services to help them navigate their pregnancy so both they and their child can have the healthiest start possible. Children with special care needs is the division that serves and leads the process for children that have developmental disabilities or delays. So for children that are between the ages of 0 and 3, they're in our early intervention program, and our nurse case managers provide service coordination. So we ensure the evaluations are done, and we then coordinate getting the care that those evaluations show the children need. Our physically handicapped children's program is much smaller, but it does give us an opportunity to help provide some services and equipment for children in need that might not otherwise be able to get them. And then preschool education, we are really a fiscal manager of that. Once a child turns 3, they transition into the school-based systems, but we still pay for that along with the state. So we do work with the school districts and the providers to be a part of the care team to develop the plans for the children, but ultimately our main goal is to be the fiduciary. And then our fourth division is environmental health. They are our regulatory arm of the department. They do all things sewage and water. So we've obviously been very popular around the water issue in the last couple of years, both not having enough and then having some that potentially had some lead exposure. So they've been very busy in those areas, but that is a big part of what they do in environmental health. Food service, restaurants, probably the thing that people link most to health departments is that we are responsible for making sure the restaurants have safe food handling practices and folks are not getting ill. And then, of course, facilities. We were talking about mobile home parks a minute ago. We do play a role in trying to make sure those are safe and healthy for the inhabitants. And that we also do swimming pools, temporary residences, and other facilities where it might make sense to have a healthy and safe place where people are gathered. So those are our four divisions at the health department, and a little bit about what each of them does. Our major influences slide for this year, spoiler alert, we don't have any OTRs. So these aren't necessarily focused on funding so much as much of what has been driving our activities over the last couple of years is trying to figure out how do we deal with these emerging issues. We feel comfortable. You've been very generous over the last couple of years in giving us some additional FTEs to help deal with the day-to-day work as it has grown. And really now where we're trying to settle is on how do we continue to do the work that needs to be done on a day-to-day basis, but also be prepared for these emerging issues that keep coming. And it seems like we're continually saying, well, as soon as we get past X issue, things will calm down. And then Y issue comes, and then Z, and now we're on, like, DDD issue, right? So Zika, the harmful algae blooms this summer, lead, of course, vaccine-preventable diseases. Unfortunately, we're having to spend time on that. And then we've spent a good bit of time with electronic health records. Some ups and downs with that. We're hopefully on an upswing for two of the divisions this year and finishing up next year. And those will hopefully help us be more efficient in the work that we're doing. So our recommended budget, we were asked to keep ourselves even, and we actually are saving, right? Is that what that says? $1,240 from 17 to 18. Obviously, when we're talking about, you know, $12.6 million in expenditures, there's a lot of wiggle room in a lot of different areas, and we feel like we're in a good spot with the staffing that we have and the resources that we're being provided to do the work that we're being asked to do. Our full-time equivalence is essentially the same. The change that you see there is one of our deputy medical examiners, Dr. Klapek, who is actually also our medical director. He no longer wanted to serve as a deputy ME. So with him leaving, we actually had two deputy MEs, and we've replaced them, both of which were 0.1 FTEs, with a contract with the physicians in the pathology group at CMC. And so they are now providing the deputy role for our medical examiner services under a contract. It's the same dollar value. We kept it revenue neutral, but that's the change in the FTE that you see there. So the recommended budget, we wanted to break it out for you based on the four main areas that we talked about and then our mandate accounts. So you see administration there, as we talked about, and both the expenditures, revenues, the local share, and the FTEs associated. And you can see that for each of the divisions as well as our large mandate accounts. And just so you know, our mandates include the early intervention and preschool programs, as well as the medical examiner services that are required by law. So that's just a little bit of a breakdown. We also broke out, just to kind of give you a perspective, the thing we spend the most of our money on, our most important resources, are people. And so we very much understand that, and we try to make sure that we value that we provide our community with the appropriate staffing to do the work that we need to do, but at the same time giving the staff the resources that they need to do the job that they do. But we often talk about our employees being our most important resource, and they absolutely are, and it bears itself out here. And with that, spoiler from the beginning, again, we have no OTRs this year. You've been very generous in the last couple of years with some additional FTEs, as I've said, and we really feel at this point we're comfortable where we are, and understand that the county has some difficult decisions to make, and we support you and hope that goes well for you. So happy to take questions.
Anna, Mike, and Mike. Go ahead, Anna.
Just a question. I just came back from NYSAC, and one of the things that the state was talking about is that the challenge of working with health departments and not having their software, but not having their data be equally or readily accessible. Is it possible, because I know that what you're working on could potentially be somewhat customized, that we could ultimately share that and engage and collaborate with other counties so that that engagement with the state is potentially easier? Or is it very custom to our county?
It depends on the data and which program you're talking about. Our environmental health program, the Paperless Initiative Accela project that you all funded a few years ago, our intent is to be able to transfer our information to the state. We've got to get the system fully developed and then work with the state to make that happen, but that is fully the intent. Our electronic health record in community health services, the expectation is that it will communicate with the RIO, which is the Regional Health Information Organization, which is the repository for all electronic health records, and a component of the RFP and expectation from the vendor will be the ability to do that. Children with special care needs, boy, would we love to connect to the state system, but they won't let us. Their system doesn't work, and I think, and I have no problem saying that publicly here, because I think it's fairly public knowledge at this point, not a secret. And I think there's a fear that if they give counties or other vendors access to their system, it will make a bad problem worse. And so our hope is that they will eventually find a different solution that is more readily accessible for us. So that's a long answer to the question. Yes, in every instance, we want to be able to communicate to the state. And if there is an opportunity, once we have something in place of partnering with another municipality in Tompkins County and or a county surrounding us, we would certainly be open to hearing that.
So the second half of that is, I know that you were looking into the RFP, the possibility of having a system that could interface between the mental health and the public health. Where are we in the process with the RFP, putting that out?
We're putting the finishing touches on the RFP, so probably within 4 to 6 weeks that will be out. And, yes, the goal is to find a system that will support both places. One, it helps ITS in that we only have one system that they have to learn. But two, we really think there's going to be benefit in the future of our programs being able to share data about shared clients.
Right, and the big thing that they were talking about was the opioid epidemic and being able to collect that data, and they're having real difficulty now. So obviously that would be more mental health, I think. Right? So, okay.
Mike Sigler.
I was just wondering, we added a nurse, early intervention, I think, last year. And it's not controversial, but it's like, we really need this, and I wanted to see how that worked out.
Yeah, it's actually gone really well, and for the first time, actually, we are fully staffed with that position. All of the nurses are at least 6 months in up there, so they are doing work on their own in the program, and it has been a huge relief from a caseload perspective. And one really significant improvement is it has freed up time for us to now go participate in the municipal meetings around the children that are in the pre-K program. Before, we weren't able to send anyone. And so we weren't able to bring our expertise around the services that we provide for the younger children. And we were quite honestly missing from the table as the funder to be able to be a part of that discussion. So that's one key improvement that we've been able to do on top of reducing the stress from caseloads.
Awesome.
Mike Flynn.
Something you said at the beginning generated a question in my mind. You mentioned Florida and the awful things that are happening down there. and particularly the recent news about the nursing home where the patients passed away because of the failure of their electric generator. Do you know, do we require our nursing homes in Tompkins County to have emergency generators?
I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that they are responsible to report to the state their emergency preparedness plans. And ahead of major storms, the state does sends out a survey. It's called a HERD survey. It's an electronic one. And they are responsible for reporting their current census, talking about what they think the risk is for the particular issue that's coming up, and what their plans would be if they had to, if they had a power outage or needed to evacuate their building. So there is state requirement. We don't directly regulate them, so we're not necessarily privy to all of that information. But we do know that the state gathers it. And there are times where they ask us on their behalf to go talk to some of these facilities if they're not getting the information that they might need. But the short answer is I don't know if they all do or, to be honest, if they're even required to.
Would that information be available at the state level? We could ask them?
Yeah, we could certainly get the answer for that.
Thank you. Anyone else for public health? Julie.
I didn't understand what you said about now having to contract with Cayuga Medical Center for pathology services. Could you go into that a little bit more for me?
I can. It's not for pathology services. It's for medical examiner services. Excuse me. So when there's an unattended or suspicious death, the medical examiner is responsible for the body. And so... our medical examiners, whenever that occurs, is contacted by law enforcement, and they have to review the information available and make a determination as to whether it's going to be a medical examiner case or not. And then they make determinations about autopsy and what type of autopsy needs to be done. That was the service that changed, not the actual autopsy or pathology services.
What entity within CMC are you contracting with?
The pathology group. I don't know.
That's what I was curious about.
Yeah.
What is the pathology group there?
So it's Pathology Associates of Ithaca.
They are the ones that essentially run the lab and do internal autopsies
It's a contract with Cayuga Medical Center also?
No, it's a contact with this pathology group. There's two doctors that are part of the pathology group. They work at CMC and run their laboratory and do their internal autopsies.
Okay, thank you. I had another question, a different one, of course. Somewhere, someone used to, probably environmental health, tell the county facilities department what pesticides are okay to use and which aren't. Is there still someone who does that?
Our health and safety officer, not in environmental health, but the health and safety officer, it's an administration, does play a role in working with facilities on choosing the safest products that we can.
So it's in administration?
Okay. Yes. Yep.
And that's your bailiwick. Okay. Thank you.
Anna?
Again, this was something that came up, so we texted briefly. But this is the resolution that was up in the standing committee that I was in. So I just wanted to confirm so that I make sure I have the right information. This used to be funded by the state, and it has been systematically cut, and now the state doesn't give any funding anymore for this. Is that true?
Are you talking about AOT?
Yeah. That's about the examiners, the medical examiners.
Yes, you're right. I'm sorry. You actually texted me about a different issue. But the medical examiner one is one that the state is taking up. There are counties that I believe Erie or Monroe, I always get them confused, that really is having significant issues and costs associated with their medical examiner program. And there is no state funding that we get for that. It's essentially a county mandate. There used to be funding, and there is some historical that when the funding came out of public health, it got moved over into a law enforcement component, and then that never realized, making its way back down to the counties for it. So there is some push now from some municipalities to try to get additional state funding for the medical examiner program.
Okay. We'll see what they say.
Anything else for public health? Thank you. we are on to mental health.
I have a different crew for mental health, I think. Oh, there's Betsy. All right, great. So, Frank Krupa, Tompkins County Mental Health Commissioner. With me is Betsy Doling. She's our fiscal officer at the department, and she does the number crunching for the mental health side of things. Just like Joe, this is Betsy's last time doing the budget with us because she will be retiring at the end of the year. We're certainly, we wish her well, and we're going to miss her. Fortunately, Jeremy Porter is here, and he will be Betsy's replacement in our new fiscal administrator role, helping, he'll be cross-training with Betsy over the next few months and then filling in when she leaves. And I'll talk a little bit more about Jeremy as part of the presentation. Jeremy in his position. So, again, starting with the mission, one of the important things to point out about the mental health department is that we have two pretty distinctly different kind of responsibilities. We have the work that we do as the mental health department and our clinic. So we have our full-scale clinic that provides services. We have a PROS program, and we have a care management program, health homes that we do. And then we also have what's called the LGU component, or local government unit. So through that local government unit responsibility, we are, that local government role, we have the responsibility of making sure that the needs for mental health, substance use disorders, and persons with developmental disabilities are met for the entire county. So there's two kind of pieces to the budget that we'll talk about and how that that comes together. But our mission does talk to that, and we're actually in the process of revamping our mission, so it'll look a little different next year. So the continuum of care, there's a lot of discussion, obviously, with everything that's going on, the opioid epidemic, things going on in the jail with mental health needs. We wanted to kind of lay out right up front the scope of what the department provides to the community through the state and federal funding as well as county funding. So through our LGU role, we are responsible for providing any state or federal dollars about those three areas I just discussed, substance use disorders, mental health, and persons with developmental disabilities. Those all have to come through the local government unit. You have a community services board that you all have created and appointed people to. They have the responsibility with myself as commissioner to identify how to spend those dollars effectively in our community. And the results of that work is essentially what's in front of you. So you can see all of the different agencies that we provide funding through. Two, on the left is the state aid, which would include any federal monies that come to the state level and come down to us. And then you can see where you all provide funding to some of these agencies. And we felt it important that we included ourselves as the mental health department in there because we are our clinic exists because Tompkins County has decided to operate our clinic. And so you fund it, and we are essentially, from the LGU perspective, we are another community entity that we support to meet the needs in the community. So we wanted to make sure we were included in part of this. Certainly in your budget books, you can see more detail about what each of these does, but I wanted to kind of give you the snapshot of the funding that these different community organizations receive for different services. So each year we try to give you a snapshot of where we are year to date on the types and numbers of services that we've provided. So I was describing what we do at the department. We have our main clinic, which is essentially our outpatient mental health clinic. You'll see since the beginning of the year up until the end of August, we had seen 1,260 unduplicated individuals as adults. SMI is severely mentally ill adults, 640 unduplicated individuals, and then within our forensics program, 243 unduplicated individuals. Children, adolescents, and families, there were 323 for a total of 2,466. thank you. PROS, Personalized Recovery Oriented Services. That's the new program that replaced continuing day treatment, and we are happy to report that we now have 111 unduplicated individuals participating in that program. We are, as far as I'm concerned, ahead of schedule, don't tell staff, with how far we've progressed in getting this program up and running and the number of people that we're serving. We still have work to do to get the right individuals connected with all of the right services within the program, but staff has done an amazing job of getting the word out about the program, getting people engaged and coming and participating. And to be quite honest, they have what is a pretty dynamic opportunity to provide a wide array of different care, services, trainings for the people that are participating, with the goal of them reaching their full potential, whatever that means for them. And it's the important thing, the main shift from this continuing day treatment was kind of an ongoing, long-term, people are just going to be there for a very long time. And PROS is very much different. It's about working with the individual to understand what their goals are and hopefully help them get to a place where work, school, volunteering are opportunities for them to help them engage with the community and reach the goals that they have. So 111 unduplicated folks. Health Homes Care Coordination. This program is four or five years old now. It was a transition from our old care management, which really just focused on the clients that we served in the clinic, to the new health home models that the Department of Health has created. And so these care managers are responsible for more than just our clients. They are responsible for folks that are high users of Medicaid and have a couple of qualifying events that make them a part of the program. We are a subcontractor of Health Homes of New York. Right. Health Homes of New York out of Onondaga County. And so we are one of two contractors in Tompkins County that does that work. And it'll be important because that's going to tie into one of our OTRs later on. So total, there's 3,171 unduplicated folks between all three programs. Current initiatives and program developments. We're providing increased support to the jail. Some of you, probably all of you by now, are aware. We used to provide 7 hours. We've upped that to 21. And then we have an OTR that's hopefully going to address what it might look like next year. We've developed and implemented our mobile crisis unit, which has been in existence now for 6 months, which, if you remember, is a team of a social worker and a caseworker that are on call to be able to go out, if necessary, to help support law enforcement, families, other agencies that might need us at any time, with the goal of trying to avoid hospitalizations and hopefully, most certainly, jail visits. Open access through our Vital Access Program is a grant from the state that we're still receiving. There was a federal portion that the state ended up not getting qualified for, so it was less funding than we expected, but to the state's credit, they have held up on their part of the bargain, and that continues. And what that has done is it allows us to have walk-in service for folks to do intake. So if you want to come to our clinic and become a client and you think you have a need, all you have to do is walk in during our normal business hours, and we will have you sit with a social worker or a nurse and begin the intake process. So that's gone really well. It's also allowed us to reduce our time from intake to their first visit from a few weeks down to a week. Right? So if somebody comes in, walks in, has an intake, they will walk out with an appointment within a week to sit with a clinician and begin the full admission process into our clinic. So we've had some significant success there. Our care management unit, the health homes, as New York State loves to do, it's been a moving target with our billing and understanding what they want that program to look like, and the staff has done a really good job of trying to keep up with that and putting us in the best position. We have been looking to secure funding, and we have secured funding for our EHR system from Care Compass, so that will help us on this second try to implement. And we are beginning the process of the county
County's results-based accountability initiative. So we were excited for that to get rolling, and our staff has been meeting both with David Sanders as well as internally to prep for that. So hoping some exciting stuff will come out of that. Personnel changes. I mentioned Jeremy as our new fiscal administrator. I believe you all are aware that we envision that position if in 2019, when the legislature reevaluates the dual department head role, that this fiscal administrator will eventually become a two-department position. So Jeremy's going to begin by learning from Betsy and getting settled with a lot of the work that needs to be done in mental health, which is clearly going to take us till 2019. And then if this continues, he'd begin working with Brenda to begin to learn things at mental health in preparation for Brenda's retirement 15, 20 years from now. It is the beginning of planning for an opportunity that we think will position us in a good place going forward. We designed it to be reversible. So if the legislature decides to go back to two distinctly different departments in 2019, mental health would have needed a fiscal officer anyway. So it's something that can continue. We have created senior psychiatric social worker and senior community mental health nurse positions. This is a change from our current program director approach. These are a little bit lower salary, and the position is 50% seeing clients and 50% clinic management, but there will be four of them rather than three. And then we envision, as this all comes together, that there would actually be a clinic director appointed above those four folks reporting to Sharon. So Sharon isn't the single entity over the entire clinic. We're currently going through a medical director transition. Dr. Bezerganian left our previous medical director after 20 years. And so we have, in an interim role, appointed Dr. Lippert to serve as our medical director. And we're going to spend the next 6 months or so to kind of figure out what the future of medical direction and psychiatry services at the department needs to look like, what the true demand is, and how we can best meet that demand. And we are full staffed, as I was mentioning, in the Health Homes program for the first time due to some retirements and some folks with extended illnesses that chose to retire as well. Sorry, I'll move a little quicker. Continuing quality assurance. Quality improvement, which Jeremy was leading, came out of some of our issues we had previously with the Office of Mental Health and our licensure. We have a fully operational QA/QI program, which is, to be quite honest, it's pretty amazing to see the work that they've been able to do in a very short period of time. This results-based accountability thing, while it's complicated, I think we've done a lot of the work already because we knew we needed to do that. So we have a team that's responsible for training all of our folks on issues. They're doing utilization reviews on our charts to make sure we're meeting regulatory requirements. We started there. We're now shifting over to clinical care. We're going to be working on training and looking at those charts for the clinical side of things. So a huge improvement, and it's very important, hopefully keeping us on track and out of trouble. And then ultimately not worrying about being in trouble but doing some really, really cool things. Pros, we're licensed, of course, we talked about that. The main reception area is done. We had our grand opening, and we continue to evaluate how to best use that space to move people throughout the building every day. And our satellite offices out in the schools are fully licensed and have now been renewed for this school year as well. So, all good stuff. Some pictures. They said put some pictures in. So pictures of our electric cars. Thank you all very much for helping support us do that. Staff like them. They have certainly meeting the need, and we were happy to be a part of that program. Our illustrious chairman doing our ribbon cutting at the at our grand reopening for the first floor. So some really positive. If you haven't been by the building, and you had been in the building previously, you'd be really amazed at the transformation. It is really good. So our recommended budget, again, you all, we were instructed to try to stay as close as possible. So the $1,200 we saved in public health, we need over here in mental health. But the number is the $100,000 that you see there. Most of that is a change in pass-through money for one of our programs that
the same expense, the revenue is there for it as a pass-through. Some of the other things are related to some of the personnel changes that we've been doing, but we also expect that there'll be like revenue associated with those changes. So we're holding steady. Distribution of our revenue, just kind of wanted to give you a quick picture for the entirety of the department, about $6.5 million from state and federal funds, almost $3.9 million from billing revenue, and then, of course, the county share of $1.8 million. Trying to do the same thing we did with public health is break out some of those main areas so you can see, obviously, administration and LGU. As those functions I talked about from the community perspective, and then you can see for the clinic pros, health homes, kind of how that breakout occurs as well. And the psychiatric mandate is for folks that have been required to be hospitalized because they're unable to meet their judicial requirements. Full-time equivalents, it is virtually the same. The 0.1 is one of our nurses has gone back to school to become a nurse practitioner, so she has to go down to 4 days from 5 days, and that's where that change comes in. And our over-target requests. So where to start? let me start with the Mental Health Association. So the Mental Health Association is a local organization here that provides a wide array of services. They run the, what's the drop-in center?
The Jenkins Center.
They do provide some services up at the jail. Some of you may know Jacob Parker Carver, who does a lot of their outreach, and they do training in the community on mental health first aid. They do a lot of work on reducing stigma, and they provide services to folks suffering from mental illness. And they approached us late in the process because they are struggling, as many nonprofits are, with maintaining their staff. And a lot of it has to do with salaries. And so we sat down with them, and when they presented, and as it's presented here, you know, it's a tough sell. You know, right? Almost any nonprofit in the community could probably come in and say, you know, we're struggling with our salaries and being competitive. And so we've had some conversations with them about looking at this a little bit differently, because I think what really is their underlying problem is they've been asked by the community to do a lot of different services, and they've done everything they can to try to meet those needs. And I think in this instance, they've done it to a point where it's starting to be a detriment to the overall organization and potentially affecting their sustainability. So rather than just talking about we need more money to raise salaries, we tried to shift the thinking around, well, what is the core function? What is it that you need to do? And what will it cost you to reasonably do that, right? If you need to pay the people the salary, you need to pay them, what would it need to be and what would that look like? And then what are the other programs that you've been asked to do, and what are those costs? And then let's look at how do we secure funding for those additional things that you're being asked to do. So we've done a little bit of that work. We met with Josephine Cohen, who is the executive director, and her staff there. We've had some brief discussions with the Community Services Board about this as well. And I think there is opportunity to bring something back that's different than just we need more money to pay our people more to be competitive. So we're continuing to work on that. They did provide us some updated information, which we can provide to all of you. The Community Services Board met Monday and talked a little bit about this. They are generally supportive of the Mental Health Association, but they have now invited them to the Mental Health Subcommittee to come talk a little bit about what they do and how they might need additional support. These are here. We can give you that new information if you'd like it and want to consider it further. But we were clear with them that this was kind of a first step. They came to us. I never want to tell someone, no, we're not going to even put it out there for people to look at. But I think we need a little bit more time to bring something back that gives you all, you know, a little bit more meaty kind of proposal for this. So I don't know that we're going to do that in this budget cycle, and I think that's conversations we'll have to have with the Mental Health Association, wanting to get them to the Community Services Board so they can weigh in and then provide some response to you all about whether they should or shouldn't. You should or shouldn't consider their support. They don't currently get county support, so this would be another new agency that would potentially be getting county support, so I know that always kind of weighs into the thinking as well.
So I'll stop on that. We can certainly come back to it. But I wanted to get to the jail services, which is our, is a department OTR. And I think many of you have kind of heard this already. We've been to the jail study committee at HHS, and we've talked about it. It's got two components built into the $171,000. It's essentially two FTEs. One is a psychiatric social worker, and the other is a caseworker. So the purpose of the psychiatric social worker would be to have them stationed at the jail, at our jail. And that person would be responsible for screening every inmate that comes through and, when appropriate, providing more comprehensive assessments on their mental health needs and their substance use needs, and or connecting them with one of our substance use providers that might also be coming to the jail to do that more comprehensive assessment. I have said from the beginning that we do not want to open a mental health or substance use clinic in the jail. What we want to do is understand what those people that arrive at the jail, what their needs are, give them supports while they're at the jail, and prepare to get them connected to the community-based resources that exist. For us to provide service, a clinical service, for one person in the jail, it would be like providing six services within the community when we talk about the cost and the limiting factors that are associated with that. So it is our goal to know what the needs are, get those assessments done so we can know before they leave the jail who we need to connect them to. So the secondary piece that works hand in hand with that is a caseworker. Now, we don't imagine that this caseworker will be at the jail all of the time. They will certainly be there some of the time, forming relationships with the inmates. But their responsibility is to work with the social worker, work with the nurse, and begin what we're going to call discharge planning the minute somebody shows up at the jail, right? So we know they're not there very long, so we want to begin as soon as they get there talking about what are their needs, who can we get them connected to, and what services in the community are going to be best to help them meet their needs. And so this caseworker would be gathering that information and then making the handoffs with the client into the community when they are released from jail. It's been tried in other ways, so this is something that, as we were evaluating what was up there and we were asked, is there a way that we might be able to help support this, this is essentially what we came up with. So it's an opportunity, one, to provide psychiatric social work in the jail, as well as some casework for the reentry component and getting people connected to community services. And with that, I think I have it. Oh, I don't have a question slide, so I'll leave it there.
Anna, you had your hand up.
The $27,434 for the Mental Health Association, what you described was a system that you want to do with them to help them evaluate their infrastructure, identify their core, identify what they're doing outside of that, what the needs would be, basically helping them rebuild a business model, it sounds like. The $27,000, is that just a pass-through? Not a pass-through, but to support the personnel, the salaries for this coming year, so that we can then work with them over the next year? Is that what this was intended to be?
Well, it would be a pass-through, meaning it would be county dollars going straight to them through a contract with us. And it was to support the increase in salaries in 2018.
Okay. And then the idea is that through now to budget season of next year, you would do that reorganizing, maybe pull them into the infrastructure that we have a little bit so it can be potentially more collaborative, and then we can reevaluate the economic?
We will do that whether you fund it or not. I think one of the concerns that I have is I'm not sure that the $27,000 is sufficient. Right, and we want to, if we're going to make an ask, we want to make sure we have that business case to make that ask. If the legislature feels inclined to provide that funding, that would be great. That would help them transition, and we would still do the same process of working with the association to try to get that business plan to be able to present for a long-term sustainable model.
Right, so this would get them, though, through this next year, and it may be the case that it's not enough, but then you would come back with a more complete analysis next year. So that's They do provide a lot of support in the jail, so this would be part of your system that's in place. I mean, I think that's one of their key supports in the community, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard a lot about that being really helpful.
Anyone else? Mike.
Frank, again, on the mental health staff for the jail services, and I understand that you don't want to have a clinic there, but is there program room now for what you want to do up there? I mean, is it the people who want to work up there, do they have the availability of a place to meet with people, for example?
So Captain Bunce assures us that he can find us the space. I think we're all in agreement that it wouldn't be ideal and that having more space would be much preferable. But we will work with what we're given. And as I said, Captain Bunce has agreed to make space available for us.
And I think that's terrific. But I've come back up a little bit. But it may not be what you think would be ideal for the way of doing this.
Correct. It will not be ideal if we are trying to fit into the existing space that's within the jail. Again, you all have to make the decision on, you know, the space. We will work with what we have, but it most certainly is not ideal.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you both very much. Thank you all very much. That group and this group, and congratulations, Betsy. Okay. We are back here. We are finished this evening, and we are back here again on September 25th, 26th, and 28th. Thank you all for coming.